Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
One of these days, you're going to ask me how I'm doing, and I'm going to hit you with liar, liar. Like, I'm a little upset about a bad sexual episode last night.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
You go in and ask them yourself, Chuck. Okay, go in and see if they would serve a party that came in at 2:58, and the answer would be yes, because that's when we got here.
The Forbes guys are going to have all this, too, and they're going to dig through the records
wrong,
at that office building. Okay, I'm sure they have surveillance cameras, and they're going to check them.
I didn't do anything wrong, Chuck.
I really wish you'd stop saying that.
Hello, everybody.
Howdy.
Hey. Recotopia episode 64. I am Chris Atkinson.
I'm Jeremy Scott.
And once again, would like to acknowledge the chat. Looks like a pretty decent amount of people coming out today. Our big recommend today is Shattered Glass. Good to see everybody out here. How you doing today, Jeremy?
I'm doing quite well. How about you?
I'm doing great. Do you have any small recommends for us?
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
I do. One of these days, you're going to ask me how I'm doing, and I'm going to hit you with liar, liar. Like, I'm a little upset about a bad sexual episode last night. my first small recommend is a new comedy special on Amazon Prime. Called Hello World with Nashville native comedian Nate Bargatze. That is how his daughter says his last name as she introduces him. I don't know if you've ever seen any of his specials.
I've seen one.
But his daughter typically introduces him from backstage. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome my daddy, Nate Bargatze. And it's adorable. this dude is so freaking funny. He just a few weeks ago broke a sales record for Bridgestone Arena in Nashville, where the Predators play. Sold more tickets to a concert there than had ever been sold. Part of this is due to his ingenious, tiny, in-the-round stage that just allows for more chairs to be put around it. He's known as the clean comedian. In fact, there's a part in this special where he says the word sucks. I'm talking about how he couldn't say that as a kid. And then he lambasts himself. He's like, this is a family show and I'm bringing this filth to the stage. He doesn't cuss. He doesn't do sex jokes, but he makes me laugh almost as hard as any comedian ever has. He is every bit the storyteller that Mike Birbiglia is. It's just that Birbiglia usually has some gut punches and some real heart at the end of it all, whereas Bargatze is pretty much having a good time. It's 60 minutes long. My wife and I couldn't stop laughing for an entire hour, which is why you watch stand-up comedy specials. He does a whole bit about being the oldest child, and he does a whole bit about being his sister, being the youngest child. It's 20 minutes of material, and then he starts the next joke and then goes, oh, wait, we also have a middle brother. And then moves on, and the entire place explodes. He just, it's all about the timing and the delivery of his jokes. And I want more people to watch him who have not watched him. And he has two specials on Amazon Prime, and I think he's got one either on Hulu or Netflix. Anyway, this one's called Hello World. I give it all my thumbs up. It's a really, really good time.
Yeah, I really like this guy. I've seen, I think, one of his Netflix specials before. I probably haven't seen nearly enough of him, though. So I'll have to give this one a look. I really do like him a lot. And especially, I like the, you know, the local boy done good type of work type of thing, too. So I have to give him some more attention. Something that's not local. Yeah, that's a really good segue. I watched the 1978 Terrence Malick film Days of Heaven. This was sort of like it was like, it's time. I haven't been on the Criterion Channel in a bit, so I'll see what they got offering up on here. So this one came up. This movie stars Richard Gere and Brooke Adams and Sam Shepard. Richard Gere, at the beginning of this movie, he's working at a factory and you can't really hear much going on. I did have subtitles going on this, but there's some sort of mystery thing that seems to be happening with he and his boss during the scene. It's set in the 19 teens, like the 1916, 1917, somewhere around there. There's some sort of argument or heated thing that happens at the very beginning. Richard Gere strikes his boss and, like, I don't know, kills him or knocks him unconscious. Either way, he's not working there anymore. He gets the hell out of Chicago. He's hanging around his girlfriend, who he always introduces as his sister in this movie. I don't know why. I didn't quite catch why. So, like, for a while there, I was sitting there going, so are they really just brother and sister and they're just sleeping together and all this? Like, but that look you're making right now is exactly what people who understand what kind of couple they are thinking too. Like, didn't you just say they're brothers? It's hard to hide if you're in love with somebody and that type of thing. They also bring around his girlfriend's sister, who is the narrator. And if you're if you know anything about Terrence Malick movies, there's always someone who's like giving that ethereal, quiet narration through the movie. That's what her function is. They go to the panhandle of Texas and they get jobs out in this wheat field. This extremely wealthy guy, played by Sam Shepard, is the owner of this place. We find out that he's been given by his doctor a year to live, and we know that he has started to develop a shine for Brooke Adams, Richard Gere's girlfriend, and Richard Gere says, "Hey, you should go after that. You should marry him, and then when he dies, then, you know, we can take over his fortune." And that's sort of the way that movie is set up, is that's what's going on here. And the movie is just beautiful to look at. I was struck at how gorgeous it was. It did win the Oscar for cinematography back in the day. You know, if you're not into Malick, you're probably, I don't know if you'll like this. This is a short movie. This is an hour and a half. It's really well done. And I highly recommend it. Where are you?
I haven't seen this one. I've seen Badlands, but I've not seen this one. I like Badlands.
Yep.
And I know that for most people, Malick is either yes or no, but I actually find him 50-50 for me. I haven't seen this one. I have to put it on the list. It sounds kind of interesting and a little possibly incestuous. But
yeah, it's I don't know. I had read afterwards. I had to read afterwards because I didn't really get the connection for the longest time, but the Wikipedia page on the plot seems to think they're boyfriend and girlfriend, but just posing as brother and sister for various reasons. I don't know why.
Well, that's a lot easier to handle.
So
all right, cool. Coolio, my second small recommend is a huge recommend. I have now played a few hours of the brand new game Star Wars Jedi Survivor.
Ooh.
This is a sequel to Jedi Fallen Order from 4 or 5 years ago. That was a great game. This is Cameron Monahan is the voice and does the motion capture work for this Jedi character. That's the guy that played Joker on Gotham show. Mm-hmm. Really good actor. This takes place 5 years after that first game. So first out of the gate, your main character, Cal, has a lot more powers, a lot more force abilities. One of my only complaints about the first game was that it took so long to get good at shit. The opening scene of this is mostly cinematic. There's like one place where you're walking forward for a little bit, but for about 12 minutes, you're just watching a movie. I put the controller down after 30 seconds and just watched. I was engrossed. And the way it turns from the first scene into the gameplay is one of the coolest things I've ever seen, not in terms of the transition, but in terms of the story. And then the only real thing I want to say beyond that is that I have played a lot of freaking like Jedi games in my lifetime. I have played a lot. If there has been a video game that had a Jedi with a lightsaber in it, I've played it, and they have finally perfected Jedi force fighting. They have settings where you can just mash buttons if you want, which is what I do because I'm not going to memorize 12 different buttons. Mm-hmm. And the first fight, there were three stormtroopers on the other end of this platform, and I mashed boom, 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 and I force pulled one of the stormtroopers through the air right in front of me and stabbed him through the throat with my lightsaber. And I got out of my chair and cheered. It was one of the most exhilarating things I've ever experienced in a video game. I can't wait to play the rest of this game. I hope it doesn't go downhill from here. It also has a really extensive leveling up system. So in many ways, this is an RPG. You gain points and then you can spend them on certain abilities. But the coolest thing about this game is you can spend one credit, if you will, and wipe out everything you've chosen and then redraw it, choose different abilities and choose a different tree. After you've played the game for a while, you might find you prefer certain types of abilities to others that you didn't make the choices correct, but you can undo all of it with one turn and start again. Anyway, yes, maybe this is a game even one of us should stream at some point. Highly, highly recommend. Caution to you who love physical media. From what I understand, if you buy the physical version of this game, you get a box that has a digital download code in it, not a disc. So you may as well just buy it online and download.
Makes no sense. Why would they do that?
I think they're really trying to force people off of physical media. It's probably more expensive to print a game on a disc.
Yeah, but
than to just make a box, send it out.
Don't make it available physical disc then.
Yeah, I mean, I agree.
I mean, I guess they're technically not, but just don't make it available in stores. And
it's kind of a dick move. If you get that thinking, all right, you pull it out, it's not a disc. You're like, shit, now I have to wait. Download this game for an hour.
Yeah, I know. Jesus. All right. The next movie I saw, I'm pretty sure you've seen this one, Jeremy. It's Infernal Affairs from 2002. It is the movie that the Departed remade 4 years later, Martin Scorsese. I wanted to give this one another look. I'd seen it a long time ago, but I think I'd seen The Departed several times since. And that's the movie that's in my mind about this is the definitive version of this movie or whatever. But like, going back into watching Infernal Affairs, it's funny. I mean, if you've seen The Departed, you've seen this movie. This movie has almost everything that happens in The Departed. The one thing that I think makes this better, though, there's no focus on a love triangle, which is what The Departed does, and it wastes a lot of time on that, I feel like.
Yep.
I know that they're trying to do this weird theme about, like, you know, like Matt Damon and Jack Nicholson, or they can't have have children or something like that. There's like this theme going on in the movie with that, and it's like, yeah, that's fine and good, but we don't really need that, do we, in the middle of all this? And it's like if you've seen The Departed and then you watch this movie, it's like cuts all that like nonsense. Now, The Departed, of course, has a lot of great stuff in it, especially like, you know, the dialogue in it and the actors and all that. But if you're unfamiliar with either of these, I don't know how you would be, but at this point, you know, it's something that we all wondered, like, why has this never been done before, where you have someone who's not only an undercover cop, but you have somebody who's a mole inside the police department at the same time. And this movie does a little bit better job of showing that this is an actual philosophy that the main bad guy has. He's at the very beginning, he's giving these people, these kids, his like, you know, a pep talk of some sort. He's got six guys who've got clean records, and he wants them to go into the police force, and he wants them to make good in the police force, and so that he's got somebody on the inside at all times. And this one guy, you know, much like Damon does in The Departed, shoots through pretty fast because he's just good at what he does. And then you have the other guy who he goes to the police academy, but he's not really considered somebody who's going to be a great cop. And then they sort of manufacture a criminal record for him. And it's also more believable. And so he ends up working with this guy. I think they call him Big Sam in Infernal Affairs. The undercover cop in this, it's a little bit more believable than in The Departed. In The Departed, I feel like DiCaprio has been doing it for like 2 years or something like that. And it feels like he should easily be like pointed at as possible undercover cop in this operation. But in Infernal Affairs, this guy's been doing it for 10 years when we get to him. He's played by Tony Leung, by the way, Tony Leung, who was in Hard Boiled and who's in Shang-Chi. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a lot of this movie feels like it's inspired by Hard Boiled in certain cases. It's even got two people from Hard Boiled in it. But yeah, it's the whole thing is like, can the undercover cop figure out who the mole is in the department? Can the mole find out who the undercover cop is? And there's this a tremendous back and forth going on. And, you know, just like in The Departed, there's a big scene. It's more drugs, not microprocessors. it's about drugs, basically drug deal. You have the undercover cop feeding information to the people who are trying to bust this thing, and then you have the mole who's like feeding information back and to the bad guys and everything. It's really well done. It's really good. And if you haven't seen this, and you're like, love The Departed, I would definitely watch this one. This one might actually come out on top for you as the better version of this movie. So there you go.
I've only seen this once, and it's been a long time, and I've seen The Departed a bunch, so I need to go back to this. But also, don't confuse this with Internal Affairs with Andy Garcia and Richard Gere.
Yeah,
Richard Gere now getting two mentions on the show today for some reason. All right. Are we ready for the big recommend?
I think we're ready for the big recommend.
A big recommend.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
This week's big recommend is Shattered Glass. A movie that I appreciate a little more every time I watch it. And it's, on the surface, it seems simple, but I think it's really deep and complex. And I love the way this movie opens and frames the events. We open with him on top of the world. He's back in his old high school classroom with his old teacher. He's famous as a writer for many magazines. And all these writing students, like, idolize him. He's probably at the time, in the late 90s, one of the most prominent magazine writers, period. And I like starting there because as everything crumbles, we get to remember where he was. We even finished the movie back in that classroom, only this time it's not triumphant. It's not, it's not happy. We're just seeing how high a pedestal he fell from. So Stephen Glass is a contributing writer for a bunch of magazines, but a writer and contributing editor to the New Republic. That's his primary job. This is based on a true story, by the way, if you didn't realize that. The New Republic at the time was the in-flight magazine of Air Force One. So as he says to the students, the thrill of working there is that your work is read by people who matter, the most important people in the world. He is the star of this entire staff. It's only about a 15-20 person operation. But I love how there are early signs of his self-esteem issues and manipulativeness. Like, the girls review a piece he wrote, the girls being Chloe Sevigny and Melanie Lynskey, and they say it's a little rough, and he goes right to, oh, it's the worst thing I ever wrote. It's terrible. I'm not even going to finish it. And somebody comes in to ask him a question, and he'll be like, are you mad at me? So there's insecurity there from the get-go. And this is, I think, an awesome performance by Hayden Christensen. A middle finger to anyone who ever said after the prequels that he was a bad actor. So one of his early hit stories is called Spring Breakdown. It's about a bunch of young Republicans at the CPAC conference, drinking and drugging and whoring. And we see these scenes, and we see Stephen Glass in these scenes, even though we will later learn he's not actually there because much of what he wrote was fabricated. But soon after the piece, there are questions. The CPAC director himself, who doesn't like the image of these wild Republican parties in the hotel, he calls the New Republic and says that they don't have mini bars in the hotel, like your article said. And so Hank Azaria is the editor. His name's Michael. And he asks Stephen, hey, were there mini bars? And he's like, well, yeah, I saw the little bottles of alcohol everywhere. And then a little bit later, he comes in with his notes all sheepish. And this is part of his act. This is part of what Stephen does, is he admits to something small but makes it seem huge. So he's like, if you want me to resign, I will. And he's like, just tell me. He's like, they don't have mini bars. I think I made an error. They must have rented a mini fridge, but they were definitely drinking mini bottles of alcohol. And this editor's like, is that all? And he's like, yeah. And he's like, all right, your resignation won't be needed today. And then he calls the hotel and says, do you have mini fridges that your guests can rent? And they say, yeah. And he's like, all right. And that's pretty much the end of the story. Because again, Stephen Glass is a magnetic personality. He tells wild stories. He remembers details that makes it seem like he cares. He is loved by all these people. And so there's no reason to dig any deeper than that at this point. You know, he made a simple error in his notes. Well, the boss at the magazine is a guy named Marty, who gets really mad because he says the most recent issue has too many commas in it that are misused. He comes in and orders the staff to circle every comma. They each have a copy of the issue, and they have to go through and circle every single comma in the magazine, which is grade school shit. And Hank Azaria comes in and goes to bat for his team. And you can even hear him yelling at Marty in the office and basically threatens to resign. And so then they're told to go back to work. Now, Steve uses this story when he's talking to the high school students as an example of what a good editor will do. A good editor will have your back no matter what, because he ultimately will feel the opposite about Chuck, the next editor. He feels like Chuck never had his back and was out to get him because he liked Michael so much. So Marty calls Chuck. Chuck is Sarsgaard, Peter Sarsgaard, another incredible performance from him. And says, hey, I'm going to fire your boss, the editor, Michael, and replace him with you, but don't tell anybody for 3 days. Yeah. And he's reluctant with the secrecy, but obviously he wants the job. Michael gets fired. Hank Azaria, and starting to get a little speech on his way out of the office with his box. And then that's right when Chuck comes in with his stuff, and it's just awkward and awesome. And I love it. And so he leaves. So now we have a new editor. Most of the writers resent him because they don't think that he has enough experience, and they loved the editor that was forced out. So we move on to the next piece that Glass is going to do. He's pitching a story about a hacker conference and a company called Juke Micronics that got hacked by this kid named Ian Rustle, who's a 15-year-old hacker and had a list of demands to unhack their website, including cars and comic books. And I never noticed until this viewing that that kid's wearing a Cal Ripken jersey. I don't know why I never noticed that. I'm an Orioles fan, but this is taking place in the DC Bethesda area. So the sweater begins to unravel after the piece is published. And Steve Zahn, who works at Forbes Digital, his boss yells at him for not getting this story. And so, of course, he's going to read the story and see what is it that I missed. And he sees red flags immediately, which I think speaks to the internal groupthink going on over at New Republic, that no one ever had any red flags about this piece because it was so compelling. And this guy is like, I don't know about this. So he starts digging. Rosario Dawson's his coworker. She's great as well. She starts helping him dig. And so they begin to have enough questions. He actually calls the piece a fucking sieve to his boss. And his boss then calls Chuck over at the New Republic and says, hey, we got some questions here. We want to do a follow-up piece. Can we get some phone numbers for these guys? And so Chuck is like, hey, Steve, I need these phone numbers. And Steve does his, are you mad at me, routine? And if you've ever had a friend in your life who is that insecure that they've literally said that phrase, like, oh, are you mad at me? Again, it should be more see-through to his coworkers than it is.
Yeah.
They are wearing blinders. So Glass cobbles together some bullshit because ultimately none of these numbers exist. None of these people are real. But he manufactures a phone number with a voicemail, gives it to Chuck, and Chuck calls and is like, hey, I've got some questions about this Juke Micronics stuff, and, you know, call me back. And then, like, the next day, because Steven says, oh, I got to go check my notes at home. The next day, Steven has found a very shoddy looking business card for one of the other key witnesses. And Chuck gets a phone call from somebody who says, leave me alone. I don't want you to talk to me anymore. I'm the guy that you called. And it's like one of the most suspicious things ever. And you can see Chuck writing down, like, sounds like a really young voice. And I love the scene here. We cut back to the high school class, and Steven lays down exactly how many hurdles there are between a piece and publication, and how many rounds of editing and fact-checking, and then back to the other editor, then the second editor, then the fact-checker again, then the writer again. And he says to this class, remember, this is before he's fallen from grace, before he's been caught. He says to this class, but there's a loophole.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm not sure even that classroom thing happened. Like, I think even that could be considered something that he's lying about.
As far as the
main character of this story is, is concerned, like, everywhere we see him where he's telling stories, he's lying. So it's very well possible that this could have happened before he got caught, but it also could be that he's just not
made it
you
up.
Know, right. So anyway,
Absolutely. But then he tells him about the loophole and says, you know, sometimes, and of course, the New Republic, there's a little background chatter here and there about how they don't run photographs with their stories because they're just too prestigious for that. And he's like, sometimes the only thing to check facts against are the writer's own notes.
Yeah.
And so that is how he has been skating by, is that the only thing you can verify is his own notes. So we come back to the present or reality, and there's a big conference call with the Forbes people and Chuck and Steven. And the Forbes people have enough really good questions that you can see in this scene Chuck start to change his opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of that call, I think Chuck doesn't believe anything Steven is telling him anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And Steven admits to the Forbes people, this is like a 2-hour phone call, I think, admits,
mm-hmm.
I now feel after the things that you've pointed out that I've been duped. So this is his fallback story. Instead of saying I made it all up, it's these people lied to me. Mm-hmm. But the people were all real.
Right.
Chuck says, let's get in the car. We're going to Bethesda, because Chuck is not fucking around anymore. And Steven's like, why do we need to go there? You know, nobody's going to beat it. He's like, somebody might remember seeing any of these people. Let's go. So the first place they go is to the building, the hotel where the hacker convention was held. And it's just a lobby. It's a lobby of a business building. And it doesn't look anywhere near big enough to hold the 200 people Steven said were there. And then they asked the doorman, hey, do you remember a convention a couple weeks ago on Sunday? And the guy's like, building's closed on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And Steven's like, I was here. That's all I can say. I was here, because he's relying now on the fact that there's no actual proof he's lying.
Yeah.
Chuck storms him over to the restaurant he claims they had dinner at. And the sign says 10 to 3 Monday through Sunday. And he turns around. This is one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie. Chuck turns around to Steven and says, you had dinner here. And Steven's like, yes. It's like, how many people? 10 people? 10 people. They close at 3 o'clock on Sundays, Steve. And he does the same routine. Like, I was here. All I can tell you is they barely let us in because they were going to try and close. and this is very much like George and Seinfeld, when he has lied to Susan's parents about having a house in the Hamptons and horses, Snoopy and Prickly Pete.
And
he carries the lie all the way out to the goddamn beach in the Hamptons before finally breaking. And that's what I feel Steven is doing in this scene of the movie. And on the way back,
God.
Steven almost gets them killed in a car accident. Chuck is like, pull the fuck over. And the only confession now he's willing to make, the next step back is, okay, I wasn't really at the conference, but I relied on descriptions from people that I thought were telling the truth, and they probably lied to me. So at this point, Chuck has to confer with this other dude. I don't know who this other guy is, who seems like a boss of the editor, but under Marty, and he shows up in like 3 scenes. Anyway, they disagree. Chuck wants to fire Steven. That guy wants to suspend him. And they suspend him for 2 goddamn years, which might as well be firing.
Might as well.
And there's another great scene. My second favorite scene in this movie is Chloe Sevigny in the lobby confronting Chuck, because she's been on Steven's side and she still is. And she's like, he made a mistake. He's just a scared, messed up kid. And all of his pals, there were so many excuses. And Chuck just breaks it all down for her. And I think he ends with, do you not have any idea the amount of shit we are about to eat? And I get the sense, even though she doesn't have any more lines after he walks off, that she has been confronted with some truth and maybe doesn't feel quite the same.
Mm-hmm.
So Chuck goes upstairs and starts flipping through all the magazines on the wall in the lobby, rereading all of Steven's articles. I love this scene too, because we get Hayden's voiceover reading the articles. But if Chuck closes the magazine and tosses it on the floor, then Hayden just stops partway through the sentence. And then they start overlapping as you realize that, oh my God, he cooked every single story with fabrications. And Steven arrives again and admits, yes, it was my brother, but left you the voicemail. He's in California. And Chuck fires him on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
And Steven suggests that he might be suicidal. And you guys might know, I'm fairly sensitive to this particular topic. But to me, this plays like just another lie that Steven is telling to get some mercy and some compassion. You know, Chuck is not having it. He says, if you're going to hurt yourself, then just you're welcome to sit here in the lobby for a little while and not hurt yourself. But I'm not going anywhere with you, motherfucker. And the final pieces of this is Chuck going in. I don't know if it's the next morning or Monday or what have you, but he's prepared to argue with the entire staff about why firing Steven was correct. Instead, what he finds is them in the conference room with an already written statement signed by all of them to their readers apologizing. Basically, this is a sign that they have now embraced Chuck as their editor. And I feel like this movie, one of the main themes is about truth and journalism. I think there are much deeper themes, but one of them is like one of the through lines is we've got to protect the integrity of the institution of journalism. We gotta do what's right. And then there's some sort of law room scene. I don't really know who, if somebody is suing somebody, I think they are. But Steven's on one side with his lawyer, and then Chuck is on the other side with his lawyer. And Chuck says, we have a list of articles that we believe you fabricated part or all of. You don't say anything, I'm going to leave them on that list. If you object to them, I'll take it off the list and re-examine it. And the end of the movie is just him reading off titles of articles and Steven saying nothing. And it just focuses in on Hayden's face as he realizes this is the absolute best my life is going to be. I can't win. God, I really love this movie. I jotted down some trivia stuff I'll get back to after you share your thoughts. What did you feel about Shattered Glass this time through?
Yeah, this is probably, I don't know, fifth or sixth time I've watched this movie. I watched this in theaters, in fact, back in the day. I really love this. The whole like last 30 or so minutes gives me chill bumps a lot of the times, especially when Peter Sarsgaard is talking to Chloe Sevigny on that floor, and she's doing that whole like, you know, like, you're, why are you firing him, you know, blah blah blah, defending him and all that, and that him going through that thing where he was like, it's like he fed us fiction after fiction and we let him do it. Why? Because he was entertaining.
Yeah.
And he's like, it's indefensible. Don't you see that? And that's that line, that it's indefensible, don't you see that, always just makes just chill bumps on my, it's like, it's rare to see a hero in a movie admit some sort of fault, and that is the like the crescendo of that movie. Like, it's insane how much that makes me feel good. And then later, when he sees that letter that's signed by everybody, he said, I was worried I was going to have to come in here and explain all of this to you.
Yeah.
And they all figured it out. But yeah. There was a question in chat that asked, why do you think Steven Glass was such a rock star in this thing? One thing that the movie may not be quite good at telling you here is, once you've written articles that make that many covers of that magazine, you are the rock star of that office. It doesn't matter whether or not, you know, you don't find him particularly entertaining or whatever. He's pretty entertaining. I mean, the guy is telling his stories like, you know, and he's a young guy too. He's a super young guy. Good looking like guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to the fact that, you know, that's one thing that you may be missing from this movie, is that I don't think it quite tells you what kind of rock star he is, because you just see him interacting in the office like any other person. He's so, like, you see all of his like weaknesses and everything. Yeah. You know, why would anybody like this guy? I was like, well, yeah, he's not only is he the rock star, but yes, those compliments that he pays everybody as they go around, those go a long way, guys.
Yep.
Those go a long way. If you want to be a brown noser kind of person and do it in a like a less Eddie Haskell way that he does it, people remember that. He remembers all these weird details about, like, there's the scene at the party where he labels the Diet Cokes, and Melanie Lynskey asked him, why did you do that? And he goes, well, you said something about, and I can't remember what the reason was for it.
Oh, she doesn't like Diet Coke on ice because the ice waters it down.
Right. So she goes, oh, you did, but I said that 2 years ago. That type of detail is a kind of thing that is going to endear you to a lot of people. So it's pretty clear why he's a, like, you know, a star here. The There's also that, I love that thing where Steve Zahn goes through all the things that are wrong with the story with his editor. And, you know, we couldn't find a Juke Micronics. We couldn't got voicemails here, blah, blah, blah. We couldn't find a law that he's talking about. He's talking about some law about, like, you know, not protecting hackers and stuff. Yeah. There's 21 states that have a law that are couldn't find anywhere. None of the 50 states have this law that he's talking about. And then he's like, did you find anything right with the piece? And he goes, oh yeah, there appears to be a state in the union called Nevada. It's the Steve Zahniest line there is, in this. It's such a good moment, in this. I went back and actually read the article that what's the Steve Zahn's character? Well, that's the real guy.
Penniman.
What is it? It's something like that.
Adam Penneberg.
I went back and read that original article, and you know, a lot of people, you may not realize this was a huge thing for digital media back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't like a expert news organization on the internet back in this time, back in the 90s. And for them to find somebody from the hallowed print media, especially as stuffy as the New Republic is, and find out that they were creating entire fictions to put into their magazine was a huge thing for them. And a lot of the people who are mentioned in this story went on to have, like, pretty big careers. I believe the editor, I'm trying to remember. I think the Steve Zahn guy, like, he ended up, he's like a professor now, I think. The guy at the editor at Forbes Digital ended up working for the Washington Post.
Oh wow!
So, like, there's just, you know, there's a lot of people who made their careers off of this and everything. But I love this movie a lot. It's entertaining, and even though it came out in 2003, it has this kind of there's a 90s indie feel to it, almost. Mm. It feels like there's something like warm and homey about it, but watching him trying to lie his way through all of this and everything gets exhausting.
Yeah.
It's not the movie's fault. It's just that it gets exhausting. Like, dude, do you know when you're beat? Do you finally know when you're beat? You obviously have never been beat before. Like, this is, you know, he just keeps trying to find ways out, and it's insane how many times it happens.
But I saw a video a couple months ago of a street fight. This two girls fighting, and one kicks the other one's ass for like 3 minutes, and the boyfriend of the one getting pummeled goes, just take the L.
Exactly.
And I see a little bit of chatter about how prolific he was outside of the New Republic. I think his success at the New Republic alone, being read on Air Force One, would have made him a DC rock star. But he also wrote for George Magazine, Rolling Stone Magazine, and Harper's Magazine. So he was as rock starry as they come in that world when he fell. And I think the other thing that's sad is that he clearly was a gifted writer. Just like the Million Little Pieces guy. Like, you're a great writer. Why did you make shit up? You could have actually written about real shit, and none of this would have been a problem. But you had to, like, fabricate stuff. So,
yeah. Anyway. And yeah, I can't help but think that stories like Stephen Glass, and then, like, when this movie came out, the Jason Blair stuff was coming out on the New York Times manufacturing stuff. I can't help but think that a couple of these guys, plus, you know, later on, you had, like, you know, respected journalists like Brian Williams and Dan Rather and all these guys. They found things that were untrue, or, like, they stretched the truth on things that they had done. You know, all this has contributed to the whole being able to point to something as fake news. And now it doesn't mean much anymore because we don't it's like, so in, you know, now it's just put us in a state that I don't think we'll ever get out of.
No,
unfortunately, it's because of these assholes. I sort of, like, feel like, and just general sloppiness in journalism. Like, you know, that whole thing about going back, you can only just go back to the writer's notes as the main source. How did that ever happen? You know?
Right.
Like,
Well, that secretary lady that he butters up the whole movie even says at the end, you know what could have stopped this? Photographs.
Yeah.
You can't make something up if you have a picture of it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So being called a plagiarist or a fictionalist in the world of journalism is probably more damning than a lot of things, right? Like, you know, I'll use the cheap example of Chris Brown and Rihanna, but Chris Brown has suffered no career setbacks, still a best-selling artist, still wins awards. And I think beating up someone is worse than making up a story in a journalism article. But Stephen Glass got $200,000 basically as an advance for his novel. And he's, again, gifted writer. It sold less than 5,000 copies.
Wow.
I have two books that have sold more than that, and that, not by much, but still, like, he is still marked by this and will be for the rest of his life as long as he's trying to be a writer. If he wants to go operate a shrimp boat, I'm sure he can gain respect and climb that ladder. But, like, the journalism writing community has blackballed him forever. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
I also wanted to point out some fun stuff from the IMDb trivia.
Yeah.
Melanie Linsky has no costume changes in the entire movie. She wears the exact same outfit in every single scene. The students, I love this one. The students in the class that he's speaking to at the high school are all French Canadians from Montreal. They didn't speak English. Nice. That's why none of them talk during the whole scene, because they don't know English.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And then according to Chuck Lane, the real Chuck Lane, the scene in front of the restaurant where he confronts Steven is almost exactly how it happened in real life. And that's being one of my favorite scenes made me really, really happy. All right. I believe we are ready for the super secret double feature.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
All right. Okay, so this is going to be one where I name a whole bunch of movies, basically, and cheat my way on this super secret double feature. But I am going to come up with a final one. There's one that I definitely want to make it, but I don't know if I've used it before.
Oh,
so, and we talk about this movie a lot, and I think if just from those clues, you might know what I'm talking about. But the one that I really want to make it, which I'm not going to settle on because I'm not sure if I've said it before, is The Informant. The Matt Damon lies, and Melanie Linsky is in that movie too, by the way.
She is.
The way Matt Damon lies in The Informant is so much like what Hayden Christensen does in there. And it's like, even when he's beat, he just keeps trying to find ways to lie afterwards. Yep. It's just, and finally Scott Bakula is like, you need to stop lying. A lot of the things that Stephen Glass does in this reminds me of Marka Whitaker in The Informant. So I don't know if I've used The Informant before, but that would be my 1A on this. Some other ones that came to mind are Catch Me If You Can, which of course, you know, kind of like what you said last week, I don't want to really make that one, because we've already made that a big recommend, and I don't want to make that the, super secret double feature for this. But Catch Me If You Can has some of the same stuff where DiCaprio, especially in that doctor scene where he's like, you know, do you concur and all that? And like, and he's making people who have way more medical education than he does feel bad about themselves. And that's what Glass does in this when he's telling these fake stories that nobody ever runs into the stuff like Stephen Glass does. And why can't I run into stories like he does? You know, that type of thing. Is it because you're not making them up? Unfortunately, you know, Peter Sarsgaard over there. Peter Sarsgaard's over there. I'm going to go to Haiti and talk about Haiti, you know, and like, it's like, that doesn't sound exciting. but there was there was another one too. I mean, obviously the Talented Mr. Ripley, another Matt Damon movie, where he's lying throughout, but that one feels more like, I mean, it's still, he's still, especially towards the end where he's trying to convince Gwyneth Paltrow at the end of that movie.
Yeah.
It would be, I ended up though on a movie that came out a few years ago, Bad Education.
Oh, yes.
Hugh Jackman, Allison Janney movie where he's stealing.
I've seen this.
Yeah.
Oh, this movie's great.
Yeah. It's about a, you know, he's a principal in that school that's stealing. Yes. He's stealing school funds that they basically lie to all the parents about, like how great their test scores are and everything. And he steals all the funding he gets from that and like all this extravagant stuff. And Allison Janney is kind of like a side partner in all of this, and she gets to buy a whole bunch of stuff too from all this money. But that's another one, because like Hugh Jackman, like, is another character where, you know, he's very well liked, and like, how could he possibly be a liar? How could he possibly be somebody who steals money and all that? That's what sort of what goes through that movie for the longest time, until finally it's like, all right, yeah, he's doing this shit. So that's what I ended up on, Bad Education. And I, like I said, The Informant would be a good one as well. Like I said, I don't know if I've said that one before for another answer, but I'm going to stick with Bad Education.
I love that one. It's a really good movie, and I need to watch it again. I haven't seen it in probably, well, since it came out. I watched it two or three times, though. That girl who plays the journalist, the student journalist that unravels all of it, is really good in that movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Awesome. All right. What is the homework for everybody for next week?
All right. So continuing with the comedies through the decades, we're in 1940 now, the 1940s. And yes, actually 1940. I'm going to do His Girl Friday. If you've never seen this, this is like one of those, like, you know, line a minute screwball comedies that came out back in the day. Blink and you'll miss three jokes probably type of how fast everybody's talking in this movie. There's a suggestion for Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. I was going to make that the choice. Costello Meet Frankenstein. But it appears that it's not streaming anywhere. You can rent it on Amazon, and I kind of just want, I think we both do this where it's like, yeah, you can rent it, but I don't want to make everybody go rent a movie just to talk about it later on the podcast. And we've done that before. It's just that I'm kind of getting tired of it, where it's like, oh, that'd be a good movie. And then it's like nowhere streaming. You can rent it. You can rent it. But this His Girl Friday is everywhere.
Yeah. So I was just about to say that. It's everywhere.
So that's why it ends up winning over some others that could have made the cut. But this one is a choice movie. It's very good, very funny. So we'll all have fun with that. Also, of course, in the 1940s was Arsenic and Old Lace. Remember,
yes,
we did that one back in the day. Also Cary Grant. We're going to do that one this time. And like I said, I wish we could have done Abbott and Costello. Would have continued with the comedy troupe thing, or the comedy star thing. But if it's not streaming somewhere, and I have to tell you, hey guys, pay the $4. I mean, I'm sure most of you would do it.
I get you.
So anyway, that's what ended up.
All right. I like it. I've never seen this movie. So this will be coming off my list of shame, and I'm excited to get to it. I love me some Cary Grant. His Girl Friday is homework for next week. We have time for a question or two.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
This question asker didn't ask a question and just demanded that we recast each other's favorite movies. And the last time I remember you saying a declaration of a favorite movie, it was still Back to the Future.
Still is.
So that is what I have recasted it.
Okay.
And I'm going to go with Tom Holland for Marty.
Perfect.
I think he can pull off the charm, the charisma. His girlfriend, Jennifer, I'm going to use Joey King here.
Okay.
Actors are chess pieces for me to move around a board.
Indeed.
And
And like they, because, and her name is King.
Exactly. Lorraine is going to be Margaret Qualley, who will do just like the original and be made up to look older in the present day scenes.
Yeah, I like her quite a bit.
George is going to be Asa Butterfield because I think he can pull off that he would be lanky, perfect. Awkward thing. Bill Hader is going to be my Doc Brown because I think he could do Bill the Hader crazy would be stuff.
An absolutely amazing Doc Brown.
I think he would really. I feel like maybe he's even done that in like an SNL skit or
I
something.
I think he probably has. Yeah.
Biff is Jacob Elordi, of the HBO show with all the sex and drugs and Tom Hall.
Oh, is it Euphoria?
Euphoria.
Yeah.
He's the bully bad guy in that, so it just seemed natural. And then my principal Strickland, J.K. Simmons, baby.
Oh, that would be amazing. Yes.
Yeah. So there you go. There's
All of those. I like all of those castings. I think, I mean, it's weird when we do these. Like, I always think of, like, you know, who would be great, and their ages sometimes don't quite match up with what they would normally be. Like Holland now has gotten to the Holland's not 30, but he's getting there, right? He's fairly close, but I think he can still pull off the high school student thing. He's been doing these Spider-Man movies, the whole thing, just pulling off high school students.
He's
so,
26.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think he could do
so
it.
So he could still definitely do it.
Michael J. Fox was that old or older when he made Back to the Future. So.
I think so. I think he was around that age. All right. So yours last time I checked was The Matrix.
Yes, it is. Still is.
Yeah. It started off like kind of jokey, but like it started off like I was going to, okay, here is who I'd like to see be Neo. And then I was like, oh, it would be awesome if this person was Morpheus. And then I was like, who would be Trinity? And that's where the joke comes in, but it still would be a good one. I contest, but, so Neo, I have John David Washington playing Neo.
Ooh, I like it.
I think he would be badass.
He's great.
And then Morpheus, Denzel Washington.
Oh,
his dad.
Beautiful. Yes,
absolutely. For Trinity, I have Kerry Washington, who is not related to them.
No, but she'd be great.
Yeah. So Kerry Washington's Trinity. And then I'll go through all of this. I have Leslie Odom Jr. as Agent Smith.
Nice. He's good.
I have Angela Bassett as the Oracle. I have Brian Tyree Henry as Cypher.
Oh.
And then I said, I don't know how far you want me to go, but I could round out the other cast with Kylie Bunbury as Switch. Lakeith Stanfield as Mouse.
yes.
Jay Ellis as Tank. Jaden Smith as Apoc. And and because I need more Lashana Lynch in my life, she plays Dozer. So that's rounded it out there with those names. And
that's a
Matrix I would love to see. So
yeah, you know, one day they're gonna remake it, right? They're remaking Harry Potter as a TV show. They're remaking Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
They're gonna remake the Matrix.
Is the chat asking me to cast Agent Smith? I did. It's you Leslie did. Odom Jr.
Leslie Odom Jr. Mm-hmm. They must not have heard you.
Must not.
All right.
All right.
One more quick question.
All right.
What are the biggest lies a movie ever told? Example, there's no cats in America from American Tail.
The first one that I come to is that there are a lot of places for Godzilla to hide in New York in the 1998 Godzilla. That was a big lie. And then, this is one that's a little bit, I guess, more subtle. They don't really outright tell you that this, is something, but Moonfall has so many ridiculous points it, but the fact that John Bradley, who played Sam in Game of Thrones or whatever, they can just put him in a rocket and just say, hey, go to space. I'm sorry, guys. If they put me in a suit and they downloaded all the information I needed to know about NASA shit and space into my body, I still wouldn't be able to go to space because I don't have the physical ability to go up into space. And they just like, just take John Bradley because he really, really wants to go to space someday. Or that he really, really, you know, not that he really wanted to go in the movie, but still, I was just like, you can't just pull somebody off the street and say, go to space. So that was a big lie.
I went with All Drains Lead to the Ocean from Finding Nemo.
Oh, yeah.
Which actually led to a lot of dumb children flushing their animals, mm-hmm. Or their fish. Mm-hmm. Chat's got some good examples.
Yeah.
The biggest lie ever told in a movie is that anyone would consider Charlize Theron less fair than Kristen Stewart in Snow White and the Huntsman.
Oh, yeah. Holy shit. Yeah. And then there's the, you know, the one that we hear, especially in Lucy, the old we only use 10% of our brains and we can unlock the other 90. That's from Josh. Yeah. So, yeah, that's one that they do quite a bit as well. Mm-hmm. But and he also mentions that girls wearing glasses with their hair up are total hags.
Yep.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, that's true. That they did that great. They did that great in Not Another Teen Movie, which where Chris Evans is like, oh, you got glasses and her hair's up, and oh my god. Yeah. All right. Well, all right. That's Rectoby 64. The next movie is Is Girl Friday, and looking forward to seeing what you guys think about that. And thank you guys for coming out.
Thanks, everybody.
And we'll see you next time. See
you. You rock. Bye. Karate chop.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Check. Bet this is fun for Jonathan. Hey, Jonathan. Several days from now, how you doing? These guys on this Barbarian video in the comments are saying the reason it's named Barbarian is because the house, the Airbnb house in the movie, is on Barbary Street. And if there's a shot in the movie of a street sign that says Barbary Street, I'm going to go ahead and believe that that is how they chose the title. But I still think that's dumb.
Yeah, it's dumb.
If you started with Barbarian and you worked backwards, like if the street had been Library Street, would the movie have been called Librarian?
Yeah, no. Right.
You started with what you wanted to call it. And granted, Barbarian's a great title for a modern horror movie, but it has nothing to do with what actually happens in the movie.
Do you often refer to yourself by the street that you live on, unless it's like a very well known, let's say I lived on West End. Do I become a West Indian?
Yeah, I mean, I think the street has to be pretty huge mm-hmm. for you to call yourself. Because I mean, we do this with cities, right? We're mm-hmm. Nashvillians, but. Yeah, I don't think that we associate with our street. I realized that street was abandoned in the movie, but before it was abandoned, was everybody who lived on that street a barbarian?
Yeah, were they known as barbarians? Yeah, I don't think
so. I just think that's a really silly way to choose your title.
And it's also a really weird way to defend what the movie decided to do, too. I always think about stuff like this. The one that always... in our history that I always come back to is the one in Kick-Ass, because there's a part in there where Aaron Taylor Johnson's like the girl that he likes is saying something about somebody who keeps coming to the needle place that she works at. And, and then she suddenly says that I'm scared of him and blah, blah, blah. And like, And then he goes to like protect her from him later. You know, has that scene in the apartment where he like beats the guy up or whatever. I don't know. Does he end up beating that guy up, or somebody, Chloe Grace show up in that scene? And I can't remember. I haven't seen Kick-Ass in forever, but he goes to like beat him up or whatever. And then later on, as a complete blink and you miss it moment, he says something like, you know, I guess he won't ever be given her black eyes again or something like that. And it was in the narration. And I remember I wrote two sins that ended up being in the video that said, what the hell is this guy actually doing to her? Like, they don't ever show him hitting her or yelling at her or anything like that. But we're going through all this stuff to like defend her from him and everything. And so we had two sins about that, because there's never really any, you don't see anything. He just says that one moment where he mentions he gave her a black eye, which also we never see. We never see her with a black eye. And so then later on, people were like, oh, they obviously said that he was hitting her because he had black eyes and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, man, that was barely mentioned in the movie, barely mentioned what actually happened. She just said she was scared of him for no reason for the longest time. And then suddenly, bam. So yeah, there's always things in these movies where it's like, either you've got to be the most eagle eye person. And even if you are the most eagle eye person, the justification for some of the things that they put in a movie sometimes are like, yeah, come on.
Yeah. Aaron says, Barbary Inn, INN, cause it's an Airbnb on Barbary Street, is apparently the thinking behind the title. And
That's what somebody from Michigan would say.
It is. Fucking Michiganders. Oh, mm-hmm. There I go, identifying him by his state. We got a big showdown this weekend, you and me.
Oh yeah, that's right. Braves-Orioles.
We got Braves-Orioles. And I think this is my prediction, and this is the most lukewarm prediction you could make.
Mm-hmm.
I think it will be a 2-1 split series. That's all I have to say. I think both teams will win at least one game, but I expect the Braves to probably win two.
Yeah, I know that not that this year's team matters in the grand scheme of historical Braves teams, but historically they struggle against teams like the Orioles, who are all super young and, you know.
Yeah.
And so I'm that series is one that I'm like, all right, here comes the sweep. They're going to they'll beat them. They'll probably sweep the Marlins or something like that. And then they'll go into this Orioles series, and then it'll be like, just can't do anything right and whatever. Well, so historically they tend to lose these games. So
we're still playing above our level. So I expect the Yankees and Red Sox aren't terrible teams, but this is probably by far the best team we've played all year. We've played a bunch of stinkers. And so I'm expecting a series in May to be a wall that we run into, and it very easily could be the Braves. But my wife and I are going to this like resort type place for a weekend, like two nights. And one of the reasons we booked it is that they have a falconry experience where you get to put on a big glove and their falcon flies to your arm and off of your arm. And I have been wanting to do this for years, and it's canceled.
Oh.
So they booked me a month and a half ago for it, and then this fucker changed his mind, and now I don't get to do it.
It's this is becoming a theme for you, isn't
it? Yes, it really is. This is the second time I have tried. I've been this close to this kind of experience and had it ripped away from me by fucking circumstance.
Yeah.
They do, at Radnor Lake, they do have like a hawk talk thing, like weekly on the weekend. You can go down and you can be really close to the hawks, but you don't get to touch them. You don't get to hold them. And I might end up having to settle for that.
Yeah.
Or driving out of state or something. I don't know. It's really frustrating. That was like
Yeah.
30% of what I was looking forward to for that whole weekend.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, this isn't the same exact thing because you always know this is a possibility when you do this, but like the trip to New York that my brother wanted to, you know, that told, you know, my brother was like, let's go to New York for Christmas. And we did that this past Christmas. And I don't know, it was like 7 or 8 months before we actually went. And I was waiting for the NBA and NHL schedules to be published. And it was actually well before they actually got published that, so I was like, all right, waited for a second, then finally got there. And then like that weekend, Knicks Warriors, holy shit, going to get to see Steph Curry if I can get tickets for that. And you get to the game and Steph Curry just got injured the game before.
Yep.
That was so annoying, man. I mean, it was just like,
it sucks.
It's like, okay, I mean, I want Draymond Green, I guess. That's fine.
Imagine going to that Hugh Jackman Music Man and be like, tonight the part of Music Man will be played by Brad Jones.
Dude, no kidding. Oh, my God. Yeah, and you know what's really kind of messed up about that, though? Like, yes, you came to see Hugh Jackman. Of course you want to see Hugh Jackman. But you know that whoever is his understudy is going to be awesome. It's just that they're not Hugh Jackman.
Exactly. Exactly. And they very well may even blow you away. And you will end up not upset. But, you know, for the initial... You're like, oh, I'm not getting what I want. It's like the day of the Nickel Creek concert my wife and I were going to go to. They emailed to say, we're canceling all these. He broke his throat.
Yeah, he broke his throat.
Damaged his vocal cords.
Broke
but,
his throat.
Yes, he bent it over his knee and
yes,
broke it in
neck
two.
Was neck is okay. Throat is broke.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.